And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Hello, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Lairness.
Am I to understand that this week's live event of the week got pushed to next month?
That's right. There was a bit of a rehearsal. Let's call it a soft opening, as they say. You know, when they open a store, there's a soft opening.
You where... do not want to know what I refer to as my soft opening. Listen.
Oh, quite right.
Actually, I think the show, quite frankly, has had now a soft opening.
But live events of the week, I mean, there's been plenty going on. Don't kid yourself.
Oh, I've got one, but we just had promised people that they were going to hear about an exciting pay-per-laughs show from you.
Well, that's coming up. And I'm so excited that's going to be a weekly thing here in Newtown in Sydney, Australia.
And can we name the venue again?
Yeah, we sure can. It's called the 505 venue, and it's upstairs on 5 Eliza Street
and,
in Newtown.
And is there a name for the show?
Well, the name of the show seems to be Pay Per Laughs, oddly enough. So if you don't laugh, you don't pay. Some okay. version therein.
And is it you alone with people from the audience?
Yes. However, it seems that as interest grows, there's other improvisers who are asking if there's room for them. So perhaps it'll expand into a multi-improvisational show.
Well, I mean, the way that pushing it back apparently has increased awareness and interest in it. I mean, I can only imagine you push it back one more month, they may not even have room for you.
See, that's my plan. Just pimp the hell out of this till I can't even get in.
And what will be the first date for this? For all those people planning to travel down under to the historic core of Newton and Sydney.
The official first date is November 16th, but there's two secret shows before that.
Okay, those are the previews.
Yes.
That's the soft opening.
Yes.
So
wow, that...
Yeah,
that siren sounds like a UFO landing on your roof, actually.
Well, there's a lot going on here. Don't kid yourself. It's a Saturday night in Los Feliz, California. We've got sirens. We've got Fuzz Aldrin in the old audio control box. And it's
wildfires? Got wildfires?
No, we have not. Los Angeles, at a time when all of California has been on fire, Los Angeles has been blissfully fire-free.
Wow.
Let's turn to school closings. No, I have a live event of the week that I attended.
Oh, and, tell me.
And this was...
I think I saw this on your Facebook page.
Very exciting. Mistaken. Very, very exciting. Beth Henley, of course, is a Pulitzer-winning, Tony-nominated, Oscar-nominated...
What?
...playwright and screenwriter and South Coast rep. Just put on a 25th anniversary revival of her play Abundance, set in the Wyoming territory, focusing on two female mail order brides, and in the Old West, obviously Wyoming territory. So it, as you can probably do the math, that meant 1990. This first went up at South Coast Rep in Costa Mesa before going to Broadway, as so many shows have done over the years. And so earlier this year, to commemorate the 25th anniversary, a Broadway production revival was put up. And the festivities for this fantastic play's 25th anniversary come to a climax with this play returning home, as it were, to South Coast Rep. And so opening night was last night. Our very own Lily Holloman plays the lead role of Bess Johnson in it. And you've got to think, I mean, you would know, I guess, I mean, I would imagine better than I, what this feels like. I only from the outside can imagine what this would feel like. But witnessing Beth Henley, who was in attendance, tell Lily that she and her co-star, Paige, were the first performers ever to actually nail the ending to the play.
That is fantastic. That first time ever.
Yeah, first time she's ever seen actors really get it and nail the ending. I mean, is that something? And, you know, look, plays, especially when you're, you know, the leads, you can't nail the ending, by the way, unless you've been really authentically exploring the characters and the arcs before then. You can't luck into the ending. The ending has to organically grow out of what you've discovered. So, of course, it's not to say that the rest of the work wasn't great. It just means that they really saw it through to its authentic conclusion. But I got to tell you, what's so funny, right, as actors, as show people, you know, as soon as it's over, right, you do, you don't entirely let go of your character, but you do shift into a slightly different mindset, i.e. one of, I wonder how the audience enjoyed it, right? And one of the ways you measure that is through applause and ovations. And it was so funny because it's been driving Lily's co-star crazy that they're not getting bigger ovations, that like they're not getting standing ovations and things. Like, aren't we nailing it? Aren't we nailing it? And losing sight of the fact that this is a dark comedy. And the audience has really been taken for a ride. There's big laughter. They last night when I saw it, I mean, the audience was hanging on the edge of their seat on every word. Not a rustle could be heard during the 2 hour and 25 minute running time. They were with it. But at the end of it, when they close their fists and hit that hard, you almost don't want a curtain call as an audience. It's asking a lot of us to go from being so affected by it right into applauding. It's not one of those endings that's so celebratory or so emotional that you go, oh my God, bravo, bravo, author. No, you want to sit with it for a while before you're called upon to contribute in the form of applause.
Clapping.
Yeah.
And standing. Sure. You know, that's also a big deal. So, yeah, I can see the frustration of going, I think I'm giving it my all. And yet everybody's going, hey, well done.
And, yeah. You know, almost like what actually the audience, I liken it to the audience being much like how actors have to be when they've got to greet the public after doing a major performance, right?
Yes.
You're there and you're seeing everyone and you're hearing them, but you're not really there. A major part of you is still on stage and another major part of you might be spent. And that's how the audience feels. We went on this journey with them.
Yeah.
So it's...
Well, in my training, by the way, there is something called hunkering down where you actually process the show so that you can come and be in your present self as a non-actor to greet the public so that you keep the show from dressing room to stage and then you keep yourself from dressing room to lobby.
Well, I always say this. I like, and I actually talk about this a bit in a different context, in the context of auditions or pitch meetings, right? Because I'm teaching filmmakers as well. That you know, it's great to prepare and to come with the character and to audition. But what throws people sometimes, actors sometimes, is okay. Tell us about yourself.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly you're expected to talk. Well, wait a minute. I'm playing this scene where I have to murder my children. Do I really have to tell you a humorous anecdote about me right now? You know, but but yes, you do. And indeed, that might be the only chance you have to show that other side of yourself, that side that, hey, this person seems like they're fun. They're interesting to work with. What a range they have. So it's what I always say is your actors, if nothing else, create a character, like in this case, called Dean Hagland, that you can bring into the room with you.
And sometimes known as your persona.
Your persona, absolutely. Yeah. But this is true for filmmaker screenwriters. Doing a pitch, you may have your pitch down, but what about when they ask you to talk about yourself? That becomes very hard for some people. So you've got to create that persona that can do it.
True enough. And I've heard stories of the writer telling their persona and then getting that mistaken for the pitch, and they sell that show, which...
which explains why so much of television was bad for so long. listen, I want to share a story, another thing with you that's pretty cool. You know, now, so anyone within the sound of my voice who's going to be in Southern California through November 15th, really should, especially if you're interested in female-driven work. But the men... in the cast to do outstanding work as well. Everyone does. It's really, really good, and I can only imagine where they're going to take this piece as they get to deepen into it with 8 performances a week. So it's at South Coast Rep. It's Abundance. But during rehearsal, I'm going to give a little bit of a spoiler. There is a point in the movie where Lily's character gets, let's call them chin tattoos. And one night, Lily was home and sitting in the dark. And this is the thing you learn as a theater widow, that you're alone for long hours and days and sometimes weeks. And when your partner is home, they're not really home. You know, or some other quasi creation between the character and your partner is home. But so I saw her sitting in the dark. And I saw something on her face, and I said, "Lil, are you okay?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Is there something on your face?" And she turned on the light, and there was nothing on her face. And I said, "Wow, I could have sworn you had like a tattoo all over your chin."
Wow.
Yeah, and I knew nothing of the play when this happened. So she was so in character that she had... The tattoo on her chin.
That you saw it in the dark.
I saw it. It was manifested. It was there.
Wow.
Isn't
that some acting?
Cool. And that is some acting. I mean, you know, there's so many stories of like when you might be very ill, but your character's not ill, and you go on stage and you have no symptoms of illness because your character's healthy. So it's, anyway, that is something I only share with you because I think if I shared it with anybody else, you know, non-actors, that would be a little too weird. So we won't, I'll never share that on the show.
Oh, good. Yeah. Let's not have that, Brad.
I have, a couple great, letters from listeners. One was from our friend, our loyal listener, former tour guide on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour when we visited the Hollywood Heritage Museum, the Lasky DeMille Barn, where the first feature film in Los Angeles was shot, John Girodo. And he reached out to me, but I wanted to share this with you because I know you will have some real thoughts about this and maybe even some suggestions on a way to craft a letter in response. Greetings, filmmaker and entertainment industry appreciator. Appreciator Phil Lernes.
Appreciate it.
I am kindly requesting that you submit a brief statement calling for the retention and rehab of the RKO Globe. It will only take a few moments to compose and submit via email. All necessary info is contained in the response I provided, pasted below, to a concerned individual about trying to implement a campaign to submit comments. Paramount Pictures' new master plan calls for demolition of 8 stages and multiple other ancillary buildings. One of the stages intended for demo is Stage 21 at the corner of Melrose and Gower. And if I'm not mistaken, that was the stage where for many years I Love Lucy was filmed.
That's right. I think so.
And it's the stage where the RKO Globe sits atop. And it is slated for demo. Thank you for your consideration. My best, Johnny G. This kind of breaks my heart for two reasons. Certainly one of the reasons I'm a filmmaker and one of the reasons I still continually deepen my love of cinema has a little something to do with Orson Welles and yeah. Citizen Kane. And I can't see the RKO Globe, read those RKO letters without thinking of Citizen Kane. Even if one hesitates to call it the best film ever made, it certainly is maybe the greatest film ever made in terms of its impact and its ambition and its scope and you know, yeah. what it taught us, not only stylistically, but also, you know, launching, you know, Welles would go on to basically launch the independent film movement. So it's the granddaddy of them all, let's say.
Absolutely. So many breakthroughs on that show.
And the other thing is that, you know, when I was really coming of age and falling in love with film in the 70s and into the 80s, my dream was to get to make movies at Paramount Pictures. The movies that
to go through those Paramount gates?
Yeah. I mean, from Sunset Boulevard, how can you not fall in love with filmmaking when you see Sunset Boulevard, right? All the way through to the movies that were being released at that time when I was a kid, The Godfathers, Chinatowns, Nashville. My favorite movies of the 70s are Paramount Pictures. The most fun movies of the 80s, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Star Trek movies, the Eddie Murphy movies, like 48 Hours, Airplane. These are all Paramount movies. Every time I would look up and love a movie when I'm... my goodness. Was that Paramount? Calling
that was Paramount calling me.
What do they have to say? So anyway, so it makes me sad what has befallen both of these landmarks, because honestly, Paramount doesn't even seem to make movies anymore. And that's borne out by this idea that they don't need stages. They need more office space. So what are your thoughts, Dean?
Well, this is the thing. They got a big chunk of real estate right in a prime location that if bean counters are running the show, they're going to look at cost per square footage of their space. And if they have 10 acres and six studios sit empty 6 to 8 months of the year, that is a cost per square foot that goes down to less than 50 cents, 25 cents per square foot that they're making money on. Wherein the market says that you should get $3 to $5 per square foot, you're going to go, what are we doing wrong? We should have office space that we can lease out and make money. So it turns the Paramount from a art creating studio to basically a landlord of offices and a couple stages, which is sad beyond belief. But at the same time, I gotta think John Turturro is part of a Hollywood heritage that we can muster the forces necessary to at least maintain elements of what was the history of Hollywood from that very lot. And, you know, I get it. Bean counters, we got to make money. But at the same time, and, you know, the way that whole lot is built, it is a fortress. You're faced with these 60-foot blank walls that are very pedestrian unfriendly and really put the whole neighborhood into its own corners, as it were.
So, but it is still delightful, though, to walk that studio.
But it's not delightful to walk down Gower, for crying out loud. Gower is a giant cement wall with some posters that they've kindly stuck on there and one doorway. 600,
so you think having high-rise office buildings is going to make that better?
Well, it depends on where they put them. You know, I haven't seen the designs for it.
But how about I'll tell them where they can put them. And I would like you to help me figure out the language for telling them where to put them. Because here is a studio, by the way, why even claim to be Paramount if you're going to be doing stuff like this? And I just looked up their releases for 2015. They have released, not necessarily produced, released 6 movies. And we are almost through 10 months. This is one of the quote-unquote major studios, and they've released 6 movies.
And how have they done? Anything?
And only 5 live action.
And one end.
SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, which made a total domestic gross of $163 million. That's probably their most profitable of the year, I would think. A couple weeks before that, they released something called Project Almanac, and I'm not quite sure what that is. Made about $23 million domestic. I forget. I did at one time know what it was. And later in February, they did Hot Tub Time Machine 2. And that tanked really badly.
Who would not have guessed?
And so they released three movies, Dean Hagland, within the first 2 months of the year. So we're saying in the last 8 months, they've released three more movies. They've only managed to release. So I think the next one that they released was in summertime. And it was, yes, Terminator Genesis.
Oh, my God.
And that's not even, you know, a franchise that Paramount began. So that is just a pickup distribution deal. Yeah. And then at the end of July, they did Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. That was a nice hit for them. Mm-hmm. And then something in September called Captive.
Wow.
So that is it, sir.
So I would think the marketing team has been let go. And it is just one kid and a Facebook page basically running that whole team. Because I have not heard of what Captive was or Project
I mean, during the 70s and 80s, this was the motion picture studio. And so it's heartbreaking. I mean, I can't help but want to still someday get to go there and make a movie and bring Paramount back. But I'm not
bringing back. Well, and again, I think they're going to have to maintain some of at least the gate and some of the onset stuff they rent out for, like, there's that art show, the photography art show that they do every year that is well attended, and they must make money on that. There's a lot of events and parties there, so I think they're doing well renting it out to third-party events, the backlot part. So I don't think they're going to tear that down, but I can see if there's 21 stages, two or three of them are going to be torn down and made into office space. Now, who's going to have an office there? Because it's the same thing the lot did, right? Over the
That's true. And that is actually kind of lovely.
Kind of lovely. Even though I wrote a petition to prevent that from happening, it was well done at the end. Potentially because a lot of people were concerned about the historical heritage.
So this is why you're saying that I need to get over it, that movies are made in offices now.
I'm saying that indeed, write the petition, save as much as we can, and have the future, whatever that be, office towers, that sort of thing, be a complement to the historical architecture of the space. Because clearly it cannot exist as 25 acres of completely empty buildings sitting there. And having one movie make $165 million and hoping that they can maintain all of that property.
You're so much less grumpy and dreary and, since you moved down under.
That's good.
Another letter from listeners.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
All this talk of how there is a lack of female directors has me thinking. Yeah. For people who don't know, each week we've been trying to celebrate not only female directors and films directed by women, but also taking up the cause that diversity in its many faces is something that is needed in all ways. Financially, it's needed in the business. Creatively, it's needed. Societally, it's needed. So here's a letter that speaks to our ongoing discussion of this. This talk of how there's a lack of female directors has me thinking. It's very dreary, but I've some possible hope. My daughter, who is only 7 now, is really taking to making stories and characters. She draws them all out in little books she makes herself. She also loves to make up little scenarios for her toys while playing with her brothers. By the way, that's how I started directing. I used Star Trek action figures, and I would make these elaborate stories when I was a kid. And that's how I started directing. And,
how about that?
And Alexis Cruz tried to make fun of that when we were making Spectres, saying, oh, that's still what you want to do. You want to treat us like dolls. You want to treat us like... And I said, well, I'll let you in a little secret, Alexis. Those dolls have still given the best performances of any project I've ever done.
Ah! All right.
So... So this young girl, Seven, who will be changing the way people view cinema and storytelling right around the time we are in the third decade of doing your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Fantastic.
So she directs them. She directs these scenarios, mm-hmm. and tells them all what to say, how to deliver it, where to stand, the whole bit. She is also really getting into characters and how they behave. She recently noted while watching a movie she's seen several times before, Halloween. So it's a seven-year-old who's seen Halloween many times. Well, this brings up some interesting questions that we don't have time for right now. Michael Myers, she said, is a boring character. I pray that she actually is talking about Halloween and not the guy that played Wayne in Wayne's World. LOL, it was really cool to hear. She discusses these things with her older brothers, who are also into cinema and making mini movies. So there is at least one female filmmaker coming up in the world, albeit years from now, but she's growing fast. Won't be long, and maybe she can inspire other girls. Sincerely, May G. And there's a P.S. P.S. My kids think you guys are funny, and you catch their interest from time to time.
Yeah, well, that's a good point.
It's awesome. You know, it's awesome, she wrote. So so they find us funny and even from time to time interesting.
Well, there you go.
So thank you, May.
I only try to be interesting from time to time. I don't want to lay it on. That'd be ridiculous.
No, the rest of the time you are in your persona. So that was very nice to hear, and to hear that we have some young listeners from time to time. That's exciting, and to think that we might be a part of a conversation with a future generation of storytellers. Literally, as it took me years to break you of saying, but as you used to say, the young filmmakers out there, the kids.
I don't think I've ever said the young filmmakers.
This is truly the kids, the young filmmakers. Yeah. I used to always say the aspiring filmmakers instead of the kids.
Right.
So so that's nice to get it, especially since it comes the same week and literally the same day that our once youngest listener turned youngest guest. And honestly, if the numbers are true, and the numbers are always true, right? Apparently, our most popular guest of all time, Aaron Petrulis, asked me on the same day I got that email, asked me how it felt to know that people are having sex while listening to you and me, Dean.
Wow. Okay. Why did that? Oh no!
So I don't know really where to put either of those emails right now.
Jeez, yeah, I just thought everybody was on the Stairmaster. All that heavy breathing.
So you can hear them. You never told me you could hear them.
I got a feedback loop on the podcast. Special app.
Lord!
I'm gonna turn it off now. I'm turning that app off. I'm kidding you not.
I can only imagine how my joke about a soft opening played with them. and whether or not certain kids will find that interesting from time to time. All right.
I don't know. Stop it.
I saw finally a current release, a new release, a award hopeful release directed by a woman. We've been doing such a good job, celebrating films directed by women. Many are recent releases that everyone should see, according to Film Fatales. And sometimes we've loved these films, and other times we've criticized these films.
Yeah.
We're not bending over backwards. We're not giving a separate set of criteria because a filmmaker is a woman, although we have gone on record as pointing out that it is categorically unfair that men will always seemingly get another chance because failures are seen as part of their evolution, provided they're not total assholes. They get more chances. But women almost never do. You know, if they follow up a hit with a film that isn't successful, I mean, like, when was the last time Penny Marshall directed a movie, for crying out loud?
I know.
And she was as successful as any filmmaker there was. And meanwhile, we've got a whole lot of 80-year-old men making movies. So one thing that got me down, as I mentioned last week, was as we're doing this and as we're looking at some of these historic films directed by women, how come in the course of my ordinary week of just seeing, you know, every new release that is interesting or seems like an award hopeful, how come I'm not seeing anything directed by women? It's not like I'm turning these opportunities down. So it was nice to finally go and see an advanced screening of Suffragette, directed by Sarah Gavron, and featuring
Meryl Streep.
Yeah, Meryl Streep as the head of the suffragette movement, playing the woman who was arguably the most famous woman on the planet at the time, certainly one of the most iconic women of the 20th century, and a woman who figures in one whole scene of Suffragette. Streep gets nominated for this, I think it will be the nomination for the least amount of screen time ever.
She's in one scene.
In one scene. So it does not focus, Suffragette, as it turns out, on the leader of the suffragette movement, nor does it focus on the woman who threw herself in front of the king's horse at the Derby, which is the seminal event, the first news story to really go around the world because it was being filmed, even though it was, 1913, and it was being filmed, and this footage ended up in newsreels everywhere, right, in the fledgling cinemas around the world. And that, of course, was the event that really brought in, you know, really, really pushed the suffragette movement over the top because they were having a hard time getting their story out in the press. But it does not focus on the woman who threw herself to her own death while draped in the suffragette flag at the Derby in front of it focuses on a fictional character who is inspired by those women, who is a working-class woman played by Carey Mulligan. Now, there's a lot of questions that come up about that, but I thought that Carey Mulligan did a wonderful job of explaining it, and it is certainly an interesting point of view for the storytellers to take. And that is, namely, that they believed that since these two other women, these two historic women, were actually women of means, and in important families, that it was important to show that there were women who were risking not more, that seems wrong because you can't really compare that, but were risking everything that they themselves had. Working class women who could be declared mentally incompetent by their husbands. Husbands were apparently mental health experts when it came to their own wives, according to the law.
Right.
So you could get your wife committed just by saying she's crazy. And this is what happened to many suffragettes. And they could lose their children because after the age of 7, when the child became 7, all parental rights, 100% exclusively, went to the father. And these fathers would then declare their wives insane, or the wives would have been arrested and gone to jail for being suffragettes, and the husbands would adopt out the children. So they really, this was quite a thing. So they wanted to call attention to really the more broad spectrum of soldiers in this battle, and what these women risked and what these women lost. And I'm on board with that. That makes sense. And the other thing they did that I thought was great was they wanted to make this resonate within a contemporary audience. And so they had a very clever idea, which was if you focus on the working classes, it becomes less a costume drama because their clothes are much more akin to what working classes wear now.
All right. Yeah, pants and shirts kind of thing.
So it was, so that was very interesting. And the film does a wonderful job, actually, of revealing how much these women risked and how hard it was on them. And that takes us through the first half of the film. And then we lead up to the big climax where a character who is not your lead and very much a minor character ends up saving the day by sacrificing herself. So, and already by virtue of how you've structured it, unsatisfactory climax where your hero has nothing to do with it. But also what they don't do is they don't show you at all what these women did for year after year, decade after decade, to try to raise awareness. I thought I was going to get to see a film where I got to see what that day-in, day-out foot soldier battle was like. And,
right.
And we did not see that. And when they recreate the climactic derby sequence, I wished I had been watching the many YouTube videos using that now 102-year-old footage instead, because it's far more effective and far more riveting. The sequence is really poorly directed, and you don't even know the geography of what you're seeing. You watch
two women
walking around going, well, we'll get to the king somehow. Oh, that way's closed off. Let's go this way. And then we cut to a police officer who's been looking for them, but we never know where any of them are in relation to the crowds and the stands and this. So it's disappointing there. What it did do, you know, and it disappoints me, because this is a great and important story, and I don't know if we're going to get another suffragette film for a while. But indeed, to get this made required a team of remarkable women: the screenwriter, the producers, the actresses, the director, all women, and they're the only ones that were able to get something like this made. What does it say when it's a movie about the suffragette movement and the best performances, the most effective performances are given by men?
Yeah, well, that is exactly the problem as with Bridesmaids that you said. Here's a comedy that's all women, and yet at the end, they have to be redeemed by their boyfriends. So this to me sounds a similar problem.
Thankfully, most, not all, but most of the quote-unquote villains of the piece are really, you know, who are men, are really well-measured, complex characters. And one played by Ben Whishaw, who's a wonderful young actor, of course, plays Q in the Bond movies. And
right.
And the cop, played by Brendan Gleeson. And
Brendan
Gleeson is a name of one of those character actors who's always reliable, right? I mean, so good in films ranging from In Bruges to Calvary, playing lead characters in independent films like The Guard, but also supporting characters in big movies like Harry Potter, and here he's a supporting character. He is always good, Brendan Gleeson, and usually great. So he's one of those guys I say is always reliable. And you know who else is in it who become just a fantastically reliable character performer, and really always was a character performer, even though she was getting so many accolades as an ingenue in movies like Room with a View? Helena Bonham Carter.
Wow.
Hasn't she always been a go-to reliable character performer?
Absolutely. You know, she was Mrs. Frankenstein in the De Niro Frankenstein, Kenneth Branagh, I think it was.
Which makes sense to me, because, of course, period piece, but how about then playing the romantic lead in Fight Club?
Yeah, good point. And also singing in The Barber of Seville. What's that one called?
No. Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd, yes.
Yeah, working with her husband at the time, Tim Burton.
I know.
That movie that I talked about from the director of Amelie, T.S. Spivet, this summer, playing the mother. I mean, she's always really, really good and really, really reliable. Very scary. Yeah. I mentioned the Harry Potter movies. Very scary and weird in those in those movies. So there's another great character performer for you.
Good point.
Did you see anything? Did you happen to see any movies directed by women?
No. But I'm so close.
You're so close.
Well, again, you know, it's been a busy week.
Well, I know. I mean, you had that. You had your first live paper laughs show. Oh wait, no, that.
Yeah. Oh wait, no. Okay, never mind. It's tax time down here.
I saw a independent film from 2009. Also, And I really was going to talk about it because it focused on another one of these great, or focused on, but one of the three leads was one of these great character performers. Most people don't even know this guy's name, I think, still. And that's Eddie Marsan. And of course, he's Mr. Norrell in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which we've talked about. And maybe most famous for being Inspector Lestrade in the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movies.
Right.
So good in the Mike Leigh movie, Happy Go Lucky. I mean, one of the craziest, weirdest, most complicated characters I've ever seen. But this guy is great. When you see him in something, and you see he's in it, it's always... It feels really good to know that he's in it because you know you're going to see something probably that you haven't seen from an actor before.
Right.
And he was one of the three leads in this independent film that got a lot of comparison to Reservoir Dogs. It was shot on the Isle of Man. It's called The Disappearance of Alice Creed.
Okay.
And it stars Gemma Arterton, who hasn't quite broken through yet. She's played the lead in many things, like Hansel and Gretel Vampire Hunters.
Of course.
But it's a film with really, really wonderful plot twists. I'll give the first of which is a woman. You see two men preparing for a crime in detail. It's very interesting watching their preparations. And then you find out what the crime is as they kidnap a woman, and they're going to ransom her. And one of the kidnappers at the end of the first act is left alone with her while the other goes to make the demands. And she gets his gun and is about to shoot him when the masked kidnapper says, "Don't shoot, it's Danny." And it turns out she's been kidnapped by, among others, her own boyfriend. So it's a nice twist. And there are
That's
many wonderfully placed, very... very almost by the book placed at the right time twists, all of which seem to lead into big scenes of bad acting. And I quickly tired of all the twists because none of them had to do with revealing character. They were literally plot twists that were being imposed upon characters that we never got to know. So it was a very clever film that got a lot of accolades for being clever, but I'm sort of surprised that it didn't get a wider release, and I take that as being very hopeful that it didn't get a wider release, because it means we are finally past a time where cleverness in plotting is enough to recommend something, and hopefully we'll get there with television very soon. I feel like as we've talked about over these last couple of weeks, we've got sucked into this hole where merely good plotting is enough to keep a show going because people will binge watch because they want to find out what happens next. Like reading a pulp novel. What happens next? What happens next? What happens next? But that's not really great storytelling, and it wouldn't have survived even 10 years ago on television where you did have to come back the next week. If you're forced to wait for the answer of what happens next a week later, if the show doesn't have anything else to offer other than a plot twist or a cliffhanger, you actually might forget about it in a week. But if it has characters you love, you will come back.
That's right, because characters drive story. So are you saying that because I binge watch... I am just looking at plot and negating character development?
No, not necessarily, but I am saying that it is leading to bad television. It is now. There's the reason that Netflix isn't doing anything really good. I mean, they're doing stuff that gets kind of acclaimed, but now it's starting to crest and go on the way down, and people are watching this and realizing it, that they have a formula for keeping people watching, and it's not a formula based on character, it's a formula based on plot. And so this is kind of what we were starting to get to last week. Again, another way in which good television is starting to get in the way of great television.
Aha! Damn it.
Isn't that interesting?
That's interesting. So we got to go back then to creating episodes where we think they're standalones.
Yeah.
What the X-Files did. Yeah. Some of those were created just as standalone episodes. Just make it great. To hell with the story arc. You know, we're buying time so that we can work on the larger mythological arc. So let's just make a great single standalone episode.
Well, I hadn't thought about that, but so isn't that interesting that we talked about when the revival was announced, could the X-Files not only be good and good, maybe as good as it was before, but like we said, even if it's as good as it was before, that might not be enough because it was so forward-thinking. It was so influential. Can it be as good, but in a way that is again forward-thinking? And here we are at a point where forward-thinking might involve actually going to the past. Because you're right, the combination of this mythology with standalone episodes, and that's what they're doing in the six episodes. Episode one and six is mythology, two through five, standalone.
Right. Think of that.
So that's kind of exciting.
That's exciting. So, okay. So there, so once again, Chris Carter's showing us a way forward for the future television.
Yeah, kind of. He very well might be. Very well might be. Isn't that interesting?
He had to take time to stand back and look at the whole scope of
while also taking advantage of what is going on, which is this whole idea of, you know, trying to break through the blizzard of product out there. There's more television being made than ever before. Each year, more episodes of television than ever before in history. We talked about all those adaptations and sequels and remakes that are being made on television to try to break through the clutter with some sort of built-in marketing. And so The X-Files, of course, has that, like you said, but at the same time can course correct some bad habits that are being fallen into. At least it has the opportunity. You know, the latest of these, and it was only a matter of time, I guess, CBS announced that they're bringing back the iconic detective Nancy Drew to the small screen.
Really?
Yeah. And maybe that's honestly, if you're going to bring back and you're going to reboot stuff, I think I'm all right. Like with Sherlock Holmes, I'm all right with each generation maybe having their own Nancy Drew.
Maybe.
Why You're not? Right. You know, why not have a hero for a girl?
Female.
You know,
for yeah, a exactly. Girl. And dealing with the latest and contemporary issues for women while solving crime.
Yeah, while incorporating modern technology and all of this. Why not?
Why not? Sure enough, the Hardy Boys, I would think, would be harder to actually pull off in this generation of machismo and male whateverness. I would think guys solving crime.
Where are they going to find the next Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis? I don't know. In the words of Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark, try your local sewer. All right.
And you and me fighting crime, I don't see it.
Well, we don't fight it. We wrestle with it. We joust it with it with our witty bon mots.
We observe it from a distance and then comment.
Well, you know, just as discretion is the better part of valor, I've always believed that cowardice is the better part of discretion. So you are being very brave by turning around, running away to live another day.
Right, to then review exactly what the crime was.
Put the mask on yourself before you put it on the child next to you. All right. There is a film that's out in theaters that I am intrigued by from the standpoint of what it will mean, speaking of Netflix, for the business. Cary Fukunaga, who directed every episode of the fantastic season one of True Detective and quite deservedly won Best Directing Emmy for it, and who had nothing to do with season two, of course.
Right.
He made a feature film called Beasts of No Nation, starring Idris Elba, the actor you love.
My favorite.
Based on true story of children surviving war. It's supposed to be a very harrowing movie and experience. It was bought at Sundance by Netflix for $12 million. And it's their first under Netflix. They used to have like Red Envelope Entertainment, but under Netflix, it's their first theatrical feature release. And they opened it in theaters the same day they dropped it streaming on Netflix.
No.
And many theater chains balked at this and so would not carry it. They didn't care that this is supposed to be a great film and an Oscar contender. So it's only been in, you know, some art house chains. And it flopped. It absolutely flopped. It averaged hundreds of dollars per screen on its release. And it doesn't care. Netflix doesn't care. It's still going to be quite profitable for them just through streaming and foreign. And what's interesting about it is if it, because it qualified now for awards, and because it's on Netflix, everybody can see it. So you're talking about a film that may open and close in 1 week on theaters and get Oscar nominations. And people are thinking, well, that could really change things. That could be unprecedented. Well, unprecedented doesn't mean what they think it means. Because in Los Angeles, there used to be a great cable network called the Z Channel.
Right,
here
I remember that.
In Los Angeles. There was a documentary about it, I think, called Magnificent Obsession, the Z Channel. And several films were able to play their way on TV to Oscar nominations. Films that opened theatrically, nobody saw them, and again, you know, they may not have even opened nationwide, just in a couple cities. But by putting themselves immediately on Z Channel, they got seen by enough of the voting body to be able to
be nominated.
Now, people would say, well, this might be the same as, you know, for example, DVD screeners or VHS screeners. But not really, because at the same time that one film started giving out VHS screeners, pretty much all films were giving out VHS screeners. So if you're an Academy member and you are literally buried in screeners, which ones are you going to see? The ones you've heard about. And which ones have you heard about? The ones with a theatrical release.
Right.
Okay.
So that's your tool.
But if you watch the Z Channel regularly anyway, you know about the film on Z Channel because it's getting advertised as a Z Channel exclusive. They're letting you know about it. Netflix is letting you know about Beasts of No Nation because you can't watch anything else or dial up anything else or get a DVD in the mail without seeing an ad for it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So they're cutting
shoehorning it to their own group, own subscriber list, and then using the theatrical as a way
of qualifying it for awards.
Right.
But things on Netflix obviously get publicity. So what's interesting is this may be a way to get through the clutter in a far less expensive way. I mean, think about it: $12 million for a film that gets a nomination. And then that's something that has a library value and has a value in other countries. So it's really going to be interesting to see if it's successful, first of all, in getting nominations, and secondly, if that really does lead to a change in the way people do these things. All right, we have just a couple minutes, and there is another email from a listener that's to both of us, but really it's to you. And at least we can get through the email, and if nothing else, you can think about it and offer up some advice to start next week's show.
Okay, awesome.
Dear Dean and Phil, first of all, I wanted to thank you for all you do to support women.
Hooray. You're welcome.
I put on a brand new 3-piece suit and go to an opening night to support women. That's what I do. Give till it hurts. That's my motto.
That's your motto.
Through your many discussions about the lack of meaningful roles for women, and most recently by highlighting female-directed films, you're increasing awareness of a problem that plagues not only the entertainment industry, but also a problem that affects many women in male-dominated industries.
True.
The inequality does not stop at simply the lack of meaningful roles or lack of women directors, but also, as Jennifer Lawrence has been the most recent to point out, a female performer's paycheck. Simply stated, women will earn far less than their male counterparts for similar roles.
Mm-hmm.
Pay
inequity.
Except in porn, from what I understand.
That's true.
But that's an outlier. And for the sake of the kids who find us funny and interesting from time to time, let's avoid that outlier for just a moment.
Okay.
Simply stated, women will earn far less than their male counterparts for similar roles. Actresses are not the only ones in the entertainment industry affected by such pay variances, of course, as a recent list of highest paid comedians will show. Forbes recently published the highest paid comedians of 2015, and she lists all of them. I mean, I'll run through them. They're all men. Number 10, Dave Chappelle, $7.5 million last year. Nine, John Bishop, who I have not heard of, $8 million. Eight, Gabriel Iglesias, who I've heard of because he was on the list last year and you told me who he was, $8.5 million.
Fluffy,
Louis C.K., number 7, $9 million.
Right.
Aziz Ansari, $9.5 million.
Big deal.
Tied for number 4, two-way, Russell Peters, $19 million. With Jeff Dunham, $19 million.
The ventriloquist.
Number 3, Terry Fedor, $21.5 million.
From Vegas,
Number 2, Kevin Hart, who hasn't heard of him. Just his stand-up, not his acting, obviously, in his movies, $28.5 million.
That's a big deal.
And number 1, for stand-up, not for residuals, Jerry Seinfeld, $36 million.
Yeah.
As you can see, not a single woman is among these comedians. Although
I would think Amy Schumer's close there.
Maybe, but it would be interesting to look that up. Well, you would think that... But for all you know, she might not even be anywhere near there, right?
Yeah,
because of the discrepancy. Now, although he didn't make the list either, with Dean's expertise in comedy, I'm sure people would be interested in knowing the challenges women face in comedy and any advice he might have for preparing or overcoming those obstacles. Your loyal listener... Agent Summer.
Agent Summer. Fantastic. I will think about that over the week. And as I will be in the new year teaching a stand-up comedy course here in Australia, I will definitely put the old noggin, the head-scratching noodle, to that question and come up with some advice and or, not suggestions, but observations.
Now, wait a minute. The head-scratching noodle. Seems like both a uniquely Australian and uniquely meaningless colloquialism, because it's the noodle or it's a head scratcher, right? The head scratching noodle. So that means you're scratching a head with your head.
Well, that's how much brain power I'm putting into it. I'm doubling the head scratching with another head. Which is my own. As if I took my own head and scratched my head with it.
Well, you're certainly going to get ahead with that kind of...
See, the puns is what the kids like.
Yeah, really? I was going to vote on them not finding us. This would not be one of those moments to moments where we're interested.
Okay. We'll have to look at our numbers.
Well, I will give some thought to that. Because, you know, I have actually brought up... in my filmmaking class, where I'm pleased to say that 4 of the film directors of the 8 are women. And I've gone on my soapbox about how important that is to really blank stares. So I hope you will think about it, because it might be something in this class that is valuable both for women but also for men to think about how, you know, that's one of the obstacles, I would say. What would my advice be? To get men to stop being such dicks in the workplace.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
You know, I don't think a lot of clubs, what is your experience? I mean, I don't think a lot of clubs historically were all that friendly and safe seeming a place for a woman, even if she was a fellow comic.
With the safety, I don't think was the issue. It was more the misogyny.
Therein is what I mean by safety. If you are confronted by misogyny, that is not a safe feeling. I'm going to let you in on a much like, let's say, for a person of color, being confronted by racism does not make you feel particularly safe.
I agree. However, I've just considered it's not a face to face. It is it's in the context of, quote, air fingers joke. It's a joke,
right?
Therefore, lighten up. You know, that sort of thing. That's sort of the misogyny. It wasn't somebody in the back green room going, "Hey, get out of here, woman! You can't do."
But
funny.
what I meant by safe was really not the idea that they might feel physically threatened or even emotionally threatened. But what do we mean by a safe workplace environment? It doesn't mean the absence necessarily of violence, right? The idea of a healthy workplace environment is one where you feel safe to do your best work.
Absolutely. That you don't have to think about it per se. That yeah. That it's not something you're going, oh, hey, this is weird.
The job, on. The job, anyone's job, in an office or on stage, has challenges inherent to that job. They right. These jobs should not be made more hard because you're a woman and you don't feel safe trying to give your best effort.
Yeah, totally. So
that's my advice, and I wasn't even asked the question, but my advice is male comics, stop being dicks. So there you go.
Yeah, there's more to it than that, of course. But
well, yeah, we'll and start. That's where you will come in. You will come yeah, in with the more reasoned. mine is I'm the angry old man on the thing saying, hey, you kids, get off my lawn and stop being a yes. dick in the green room at the comedy club. All right. Yeah. My other bit of advice is when we do, very soon, we're going to be announcing the launch of a spinoff podcast of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour that we're producing called Am I Right, Ladies? Featuring two women who guest hosted yeah. for us, including one who is a stand-up comic, Karen Foreman. So I'm sure advice of this matter will be discussed quite often on that show. And we'll, of course, let everybody know about that.
I can't wait.
But right now, almost within our 1 hour in the title, Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, as opposed to last week's Chill Pack Hollywood 71 minutes. This is the end of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Hooray!
You right can find so many installments, virtually every installment. In fact, I would say every installment we've ever done of Let's your Chill that. Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review.
What could be more fun? Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Hey, write us an email as these listeners did, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Yep.
Can people follow us on Twitter, Dean Haglund?
Oh, they sure can. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and put Dean in the front and Phil at the back.
As always, brought to you by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Hosted by the good folks at Blog Talk Radio and carried on such outstanding outlets as Fanboy Nation. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. Let's see you then.
Have a good week, Dean.
Bye.
Belated spoiler alert.